A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know, Korn, this whole show runs on GPU compute, and we wouldn't be here without Modal.
Seriously. And that's what powers all our text-to-speech. Everything you're hearing right now.
They're an AI infrastructure platform. Developers use them to run GPU workloads in the cloud with zero infrastructure headaches.
If you're building anything with AI, check them out. Modal.com. Imagine a computer science student who spends more time in the philosophy department than the coding lab, yet somehow ends up being a better systems thinker because of it. They are not just learning how to write a script, they are learning why the script matters in the grander tapestry of human ethics and logic.
That is a classic example of what we are diving into today. This tension between the standardized path and the individual journey is reaching a boiling point, especially with the way technology is moving. I am Herman Poppleberry, and you are listening to My Weird Prompts.
And I am Korn. Today's prompt from Daniel is about the tug-of-war between self-directed learning and standardized curricula. It is a topic that hits home for a lot of people who feel like they never quite fit into the box the education system tried to put them in. By the way, today's episode is powered by Google Gemini 1.5 Flash. It is the brain behind the curtain for this particular conversation.
It is fitting, really, because AI is one of the biggest catalysts for this shift. When routine tasks and basic knowledge retrieval are automated, the value of that cross-disciplinary, self-directed approach starts to skyrocket. We are moving from a world where you are rewarded for knowing the correct facts to a world where you are rewarded for how you synthesize those facts across different domains.
It is the niche seeker versus the credential collector. Daniel's prompt really gets at the heart of this. He is someone who naturally jumps across fields, tech, communication, open source development, linguistics, and for someone like that, a static, one-size-fits-all curriculum feels less like a ladder and more like a cage.
I mean, that is the core conflict. We have these two competing needs. On one hand, you have the individual's intrinsic motivation, the what, how, and when of their own education. On the other, you have the societal and industrial need for a predictable corpus of knowledge. If I hire an architect, I need to know they understand load-bearing structures, regardless of whether they found that particular module engaging or not.
Right. You don't want the architect saying, "I skipped the physics of gravity because I was really vibing with the history of brutalist aesthetics that week." There is a baseline of safety and competence that standardization provides. But the question is, have we pushed that baseline so high and made it so rigid that we are actually filtering out the very thinkers who could move the field forward?
That is the robot problem, Daniel mentioned in his notes. If we treat students like programmable units that just need to ingest a specific set of data points to be ready, we end up with a very homogeneous workforce. They can execute, but they struggle to question the underlying assumptions of their industry.
Let's look at the appeal of this self-directed model first. Research shows that when a learner has agency, their cognitive engagement goes through the roof. It is the difference between being told to read a manual and wanting to build a radio. When you are building the radio, you learn the physics, the engineering, and the design because you need them to achieve your goal.
Think about the project-based learning movement. There is a great case study on this called OneStone. It is a student-led school where the learners actually drive the curriculum. They aren't just picking classes, they are identifying problems in their community and building projects to solve them. In that process, they end up mastering project management, critical thinking, and technical skills that a standardized test would never catch.
How do they actually measure progress there, though? If there aren't traditional grades, how does a student know they are actually improving?
They use a mastery transcript. Instead of a GPA, it's a digital visualization of their skills. If they lead a project to build a community garden, they get credits in environmental science, budgeting, and leadership. It turns out that when you trust students with their own learning, they often set higher standards for themselves than a curriculum ever could. They aren't trying to pass, they are trying to solve.
I love that. but then you hit the wall of the predictability gap. I was looking at some data from the National Association of Colleges and Employers, or NACE. In a 2025 survey, they found that 87% of employers actually prioritize predictable technical skills over unique interdisciplinary backgrounds for entry-level hires.
87%. That is a massive number, Korn. It shows that even if we love the idea of the Renaissance learner in theory, the human resources department at a major firm is terrified of it. They want to know exactly what they are getting. A degree from a specific program is a quality signal to them. If every graduate from the same university has a completely different knowledge base because they all self-directed their way through, that signal becomes white noise.
It is the SaaSification of education. Employers want a standardized product with a known feature set and a predictable update cycle. But humans aren't software. If you force a brilliant, nonlinear thinker through a rigid 4-year grind that ignores their strengths, you might standardize them, but you also might break the very thing that made them valuable.
It's like buying a high-performance off-road vehicle and then only using it to drive on a perfectly paved track. You're paying for the versatility, but refusing to let the machine use its suspension. We see this in the underemployment trap, where graduates with highly specialized, rigid degrees struggle to pivot when their specific niche is disrupted by automation.
And this is where it gets interesting in high-stakes fields like medicine. You would think that would be the last place for self-directed learning, right? You want your surgeon to have followed the manual to the letter. But actually, there have been some fascinating meta-analyses recently showing that self-directed learning is being successfully integrated into undergraduate medical education. Wait, really? How does that work without, you know, people dying?
It is about the distinction between the what and the how. The what remains standardized. You still have to know human anatomy and pharmacology. But the how? The process of acquiring that knowledge is being opened up. Students might use problem-based learning where they are given a patient's symptoms and have to investigate the cure themselves rather than just hearing it in a lecture. They might choose elective pathways that focus on medical technology or rural health. Faculty satisfaction was actually higher in these models because the students were more engaged and took more responsibility for their own competence.
So it is not a binary. You can have a standardized core, but a self-directed delivery. That feels like a massive insight. It suggests that even the most rigid professions can afford to give the learner some steering wheel time. It's like a sandbox game. The physics of the world are fixed, but the way you navigate the map is up to you.
It still leaves the scalability paradox, though. If you move away from a sage on a stage, lecturing to 300 people, and instead move toward personalized mentorship for every student, the costs explode. How do you scale a mentor model to millions of students without it becoming prohibitively expensive? That's where the system usually breaks down and reverts to the factory model.
Well, that is where the pick and choose at the module level comes in, right? We are starting to see these modular learning pathways. Instead of a 4-year degree being this monolithic block, it is being broken down into verified micro-credentials, or skill blocks. You could theoretically assemble a degree like a Lego set.
The danger there is granularity. If a module is too small, do you lose the big picture? If I just take a Python for Data module and an Intro to Ethics module, who's helping me connect them? Is a module level actually too broad, or is it too narrow? If we lose the narrative arc of an education, we just end up with a bag of disconnected facts.
I think some institutions are finding a middle ground. Take Minerva University as a case study. They use an active learning forum where the graduation rate is around 98%. They have a fixed set of competencies, things like critical thinking and complex systems analysis. But the students choose the application context. They travel to 7 different global campuses over 4 years. They might apply their data analysis competency to a project in Seoul one semester and a project in Berlin the next.
That is brilliant because it solves the predictability problem for the employer. The employer knows the student has mastered those specific high-level competencies, but it solves the engagement problem for the student because they got to choose the flavor and the context of that learning. It's the T-shaped professional deep in one area but broad in their ability to apply it.
It turns out the middle ground might be a carousel model. This is something being used in some postgraduate programs where students can enter and exit modules in a non-linear fashion. The modules themselves are standardized and high quality, but the trajectory, the path you take through them, is entirely up to you. You aren't behind or ahead because there is no single file line.
That feels much more like how we actually learn in the real world, especially in tech. I mean, look at Daniel. He didn't sit down in 1995 and say, "I will now follow the 20-year curriculum to become an expert in AI automation." He followed the problems. He learned what he needed to solve the next challenge. If he'd waited for a university to design an AI automation and communication degree, he'd still be waiting.
And industry is starting to catch on to this. Look at IBM's New Collar initiative. They're moving away from the degree or bust mentality and creating custom learning paths for employees based on real-time project needs. If a project requires a specific blend of cybersecurity and cloud architecture, they don't send the employee back to university for 2 years. They build a modular path that gets them those specific skills in months.
That is a direct response to the half-life of skills. In the 2020s, the technical skills you learn in year one of a 4-year degree might be obsolete by the time you graduate in year four. If you are stuck in a rigid curriculum, you are essentially learning for a world that no longer exists by the time you leave. It's like training for a marathon while the race is being moved to a swimming pool.
It makes me think about the younger levels, too. This isn't just a university thing. You mentioned the Montessori and Reggio Emilia approaches earlier. Those are the gold standards for early childhood self-directed learning. They create prepared environments where children choose their work.
It is the same philosophy, just at a different scale. In a Montessori classroom, a 5-year-old might spend 3 hours working on a complex math puzzle because they are fascinated by it. They aren't being told to stop because math time is over, and it is now art time. They are learning how to follow their own curiosity to a point of mastery. It builds executive function, the ability to plan, focus, and see a task through.
And then we tend to beat that out of them in middle school and high school. We tell them, no, your curiosity doesn't matter. The bell matters. It's a jarring transition from explore your world to sit in this row and memorize these dates. But there was that outdoor scientific construction study with 8th graders. Instead of using textbooks, they were given real-world problems to solve in their local environment. They had to use science to figure out things like water filtration or local ecosystem health.
And the results were clear. Those students developed better scientific thinking skills than the ones who just memorized the periodic table for a test. They understood the why, which made the how stick. They weren't just learning science, they were being scientists. It's a subtle but profound shift in identity.
So, if this works at the nursery level, the middle school level, and the professional level, why is the third level, the traditional university, the hardest one to change? Is it just the weight of history?
Because the university system is built on prestige signaling and administrative inertia. It is a massive ship that takes a long time to turn. Plus, there is the whole issue of accreditation. If a university lets a student design their own major, they have to justify to an accrediting body that this bespoke degree is actually equivalent to a standard one. It's easier to just keep the conveyor belt running.
Some are doing it, though. Hampshire College in the US or the Open University in the UK allow for these interdisciplinary concentrations. You don't just major in history. You might major in the ethics of digital archiving and pull from computer science, history, and law.
The challenge for the student there, though, is the cognitive load. If you have no map, you can get lost. If you are 18 years old and someone says, "Go forth and learn whatever you want," that can be incredibly overwhelming. You need a scaffold. Without it, self-directed learning can quickly devolve into aimless browsing.
That is where the educator's role has to change. We need to stop thinking of teachers as information dispensers and start seeing them as architects of learning. Their job isn't to give you the facts, it is to help you build the map. They become less of a lecturer and more of a learning coach, or a curator.
And that is a much harder job. It requires the teacher to be as nimble as the student. If a student wants to connect graph theory to music theory, the teacher needs to either know both or know how to help the student find the resources for both. It requires a level of humility from the educator to say, "I don't know the answer, but let's find out together."
Which brings us back to the niche seeker. If we can get this right, we aren't just producing workers, we are producing synthesizers. People who can look at a problem from three different angles because their education wasn't a straight line. Think about the field of bioinformatics. It didn't exist until people decided to bridge the gap between biology and data science. Those pioneers were essentially self-directed learners because there was no standardized path for them to follow.
I think about the Daniel profile we talked about. If Daniel had been forced into a purely communications degree or a purely computer science degree, he probably would have been bored out of his mind. He would have missed that cross-pollination that makes his work so effective. He's the person who can explain a complex API to a marketing team or explain a brand strategy to a back-end developer. That translator role is becoming the most valuable seat in the room.
It is about professional descent, too. If everyone in a room has the exact same education, they're all going to have the same blind spots. If you have someone who self-directed their way through a unique path, they're the ones who are going to say, "Wait, have we considered how this architectural choice affects the psychological well-being of the residents?" They bring the perspective of the other discipline into the conversation.
A study from LinkedIn actually backed this up. They found that people with non-linear career paths, people who jumped across industries, often ended up in higher leadership positions because they had a broader perspective on how different parts of a business interconnect. They are better at pattern matching across disparate fields.
So, what is the practical takeaway for someone listening to this? If you are a student and you are stuck in a rigid program, what do you do? Do you just drop out and go solo?
Not necessarily. You have to build your own shadow curriculum. If your degree doesn't allow for cross-disciplinary work, you find the projects that do. You build a portfolio that shows synthesis. When you go for a job, don't just show them your transcript. Show them the project where you used your niche interest to solve a real problem. Prove the value of your weirdness.
And for the employers, stop looking at the degree title as the only signal. Use skills-based assessments. Give the candidate a problem that requires them to think across domains and see how they handle it. You might find that the weird candidate with a non-linear background is actually the most capable person in the room because they aren't looking for the standard answer.
I also think educators need to push for modularity. Start small. You don't have to blow up the whole department. Just create elective clusters where a computer science student can take a block of philosophy courses that are specifically curated to connect to their field. Create the bridges so students don't have to jump the gap on their own.
It is about creating porous boundaries between subjects. Knowledge doesn't actually exist in silos. We just organized it that way for administrative convenience. The world is a messy, interconnected system, and our education should reflect that. If we keep teaching in silos, we shouldn't be surprised when our leaders can't see the systemic impacts of their decisions.
We are seeing this permeate out to industry already. In engineering, 80% of professionals in a recent survey said that self-directed learning was more effective for their career progression than formal corporate training. They are learning on YouTube, on GitHub, in Discord communities. They are following their own rabbit holes to mastery. The official training is often just a box-ticking exercise.
It is the just-in-time learning model versus the just-in-case model. Traditional education is just-in-case. Learn this now because you might need it in 10 years. Self-directed learning is just-in-time. I need to solve this problem today, so I am going to learn exactly what I need to do it. The retention rate for just-in-time learning is significantly higher because the brain sees an immediate utility for the information.
The just-in-time model is much more efficient, but it does run the risk of leaving holes in your knowledge. That is where the standardized core still has a place. You need enough of a foundation to know what you don't know. You can't just Google your way through structural engineering if you don't understand the basic laws of physics.
I think the future is a dynamic skill portfolio. Instead of a static diploma that sits on a wall and gathers dust, you have a living, breathing record of your competencies and projects. And AI is going to be the thing that helps us curate that. It can help bridge the gap between, I want to learn X, and here is the verified module that teaches you X while connecting it to your existing knowledge of Y.
It's like a personalized GPS for your brain. Instead of everyone taking the same highway, the AI helps you find the scenic route that actually takes you where you want to go. It is a shift from learning to know to learning to become, and that is a much more human way of looking at education. We aren't robots being programmed. We are explorers charting our own territory.
This really reframes the whole degree debate. It is not that degrees are useless. It is just that they are becoming one part of a much larger, more personalized puzzle. The degree provides the foundation, but the self-directed projects provide the edge.
And for the Daniels of the world, that is great news. The world is finally starting to value the niche seeker as much as the specialist. We're moving into an era of generalist specialists, people who have deep expertise in one area, but the curiosity to apply it everywhere else.
I think we have covered a lot of ground here, from Montessori nurseries to IBM's corporate training. It really is a universal tension. It's the struggle between the comfort of the group and the freedom of the individual.
It is, and it is one that isn't going away. As long as we have individuals with unique passions and a society that needs predictable skills, we are going to be navigating this middle ground. The goal shouldn't be to pick one over the other, but to build a system that can handle both.
So, let's wrap this up with some final takeaways. For the learners, don't wait for a curriculum to give you permission to be curious. Build your own niche projects and document them. Your weirdness is your competitive advantage in an automated world.
For the educators, become a mentor, not just a lecturer. Help your students build their own maps. Don't be afraid to let them wander off the path if they've found something interesting. And for the employers, look for the synthesizers. They are the ones who will help you navigate the complexity of the future. Look past the GPA and look at the why behind their choices.
And a quick reminder of that nice statistic. 87% of employers might want predictability, but the other 13% are probably the ones doing the really cool, innovative stuff. Which group do you want to work for? If you want to be a pioneer, you probably won't find the map in a handbook.
That is a great final question. If you are enjoying these deep dives into the weird prompts Daniel sends our way, we would love for you to leave a review on your podcast app. It really does help other curious minds find the show and helps us keep this conversation going.
Big thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop, for keeping us on track and making sure we don't get too lost in the weeds. And a huge shout out to Modal for providing the GPU credits that power this whole operation and allow us to experiment with these AI-driven dialogues.
This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com for all our episodes, show notes, and to subscribe to the RSS feed so you never miss a deep dive.
See you in the next one.
Taylock.
This episode was produced using Google Gemini 3 Flash. Text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where our thoughts go from slow takes to facts on cue. We change and follow through. My Weird Prompts, that's the close from sloth for man, from long ear post. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.